Hey, good morning, everybody. Hey, so this is Bio 241, and it is February 3rd. We're not quite at our first exam yet, but it is approaching. And so I want to show you the schedule, and then maybe I'll ask you all some questions, or you can ask me some questions. All right, so it's time to get started. So here we see the schedule on the right-hand side. What did I say? Today's the 3rd. We've got two more lectures this week. We've got one today, one on Thursday, on chemistry, chemical interactions. Probably it won't take those two lectures to get done, so then we're going to move into interactions between cells. That's chapter 6. So today's the 3rd. So 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks from today is your next exam. So usually you don't have that many weeks between exams in here, but the first one we start off just a little bit slowly. So make sure that you're doing all those online assignments, because what's happening this week?
On Thursday,
Thursday a deadline goes away. What does it go away for?
Quizzes.
Yeah, which quizzes?
Chapter 1,
chapter 2, and the extra credit syllabus quiz. And I think I know that some people in here have done the syllabus quiz, which means that you have over 100% already in the class. So that is really cool. And when you have over 100% in the class, that breaks Blackboard. It doesn't know how to calculate your grade. So just be a little patient. Well, even if you finish the semester and it can't calculate a letter grade because you're breaking it, you're over 100%, that's fine with me. That would be okay. But just be a little bit patient, okay, until we get enough grades in there. All right, so anybody have a question on the schedule? February 24th, chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. All right, and I'm sure I said on the recording that today is February 3rd. That is good. Okay, any questions? Somebody had a question over here. Question? No, I answered it already. Okay, I had some other questions. The lectures are online. All right, so they're on this website right here. So you're what, 241 lectures? You can mouse to it from this website, dr-j-gober. Right, or I'll put the link in Blackboard. So here's the spring. All right, it's working, spring 2015. So here is the first two lectures. You can listen to those, and then here's the text file. So for those of you that are hearing impaired, you can read. But these are from a previous semester. So these are large files. Does it say anywhere on here how large it is? No, but they're usually about 15, 16 megabytes. To me, that's a large file, maybe not to you guys. But nonetheless, it's large enough to where if you try to stream it off this server, it's probably going to misbehave. So best thing for you to do is to download that WAV file to your hard drive and open it up in whatever plugin you'd like. Whatever, you know, could be RealPlayer, iTunes, what do I like, VLC, Windows Media Player. So how would you get this file, introduction.wav, to your hard drive? And on a PC, exactly right, because I forget, I'm glad you remembered. All right, so I right-clicked, and look, another window pops open, and then you save link as, save target as, if you're using IE, and then you're going to have to say, well, where do I want to store it? Right, it's going to go into downloads right now. I don't think I want to clutter up this hard drive, but you can change the name. You can put it wherever you want, like on the desktop, but I would make a 241 file someplace. Okay, and then you'll have access to that lecture even though you don't have access to the internet. So anytime you want, you can listen to that lecture if you want to correct your notes. All right, so that's the first thing. Okay, they're all there. Somebody said they had problems with this one, that it only played for a couple seconds and then it crashed. And it might be just because you're trying to stream it off the server. It's not a streaming server. So that's difficult to do, depending on what kind of other workload that server is doing, and who knows what it's doing. All right, second thing, the quizzes. I think I've worked out the quizzes for all the sections in here so that when you submit a quiz and click OK, it just doesn't dump you and go someplace else. It goes to your results page, and you can look at every question, you can look at every answer, and you can see what answer you put and whether it's right or wrong. So you get all of that. If it doesn't behave that way, you got to let me know. I intend it to work that way, and if it's not, give me an email and I'll straighten that out. So at least for the quizzes for the first couple weeks, I think first 5 weeks, and then I'll have to go back in and do the next 5 weeks after that. So you might have to remind me during the middle of the semester. Okay. Okay. Anybody have any other questions, comments? We want to Finish up with lecture? Okay, I'll put some of this stuff away. Oh, look what I have right here. What is this thing? It's mislabeled. I don't know if they ever corrected that in chemistry, but I took this right from the chemistry department because this is what they use, and so might as well become familiar. What is this thing really? The periodic table, right? They have atomic masses on here. Don't know why that is. It's not terribly wrong, but it just kind of sort of mislabeled a little bit. Let me turn some of these lights off. How's that? Good? All right, so what do you have to know? You're going to get this thing on your test. Right, exactly this. I might project it, might give it to you in hard copy, or I might put a big one on the side of the wall over there. You have to know what H stands for. Right, because on the test I might have hydrogen, and you got to know what the chemical symbol for hydrogen is. And the same thing for K. Right, you got to know what K stands for. Yeah, potassium. So it's strange because P stands for phosphorus, right? And let's see. There's an Fe running around here someplace. Yeah, there's an Fe. Ah, here we go, 26. That's good. I should have memorized this table long ago, but maybe I did 10 times and I forgot 11 times. So, okay, I'm going to give this to you. So, I might ask you for iron, how many protons are in the nucleus for iron? And here's the answer key, right? As long as you know iron is Fe and 26 is the what atomic number, which is the number of protons in a nucleus. And if you carefully inspect this periodic table, you notice that every element has a different what? Different number of protons in the nucleus, and that's what makes elements different from each other. Right? So it's not really difficult at all. It's just that. Okay, so make sure you know your chemical elements and how many protons are in the nucleus, because that's going to be important for us when we look at ions. And does anybody know what an ion is? What's an ion? Yeah, it's a molecule or atom that has a charge on it. One extra electrical charge. It could be positive charge or negative charge, right? And, yeah, so it has this electrical property, very electrical because of that electrical charge. Are they important for us?
Yes.
Yes. We're going to look at that. We're going to spend a lot of time with sodium and potassium and calcium ions in here. Right, because we're very electrical beings, and it's because of those ions, sodium, chloride, potassium, calcium, magnesium. All right, so I do want you to be aware of these orbitals and how something can become an ion. Okay. All right, so that periodic table is in Blackboard for you to look at. So last time we ended up really close to organic molecules here, if not even exactly at this slide. Let me get my arrows. Oh, sorry. One more click. Visible. And then I want to show the whole class what we're talking about. I think I do that. Nice. So let's go back a couple slides. We talked about pH. Yeah, we got all that covered. All right, so you will have to know how to calculate pH if I give you the hydrogen ion concentration, the molar concentration of hydrogen ion. Or if I give you the pH, you should tell me what the concentration of hydrogen ions is. And you got to use your log button or exponential to the 10th power to go the other way. And everybody's calculator is different. I know how to work mine really, really fast. If your calculator is like mine and you want me to show you, I'll show you really fast. And you go, oh yeah, that's easy. Right? But if your calculator is different, I'm going to have to figure it out. But if I figure it out, it's still easy. It's just that I don't know how to use your calculator. Right? And so the same thing for you guys. Right, it's going to be easy once you know where that log button is and where the 10 to the x is. And so practice going back and forth with that. Maybe in Blackboard I even have some practice questions. Did anybody find a couple practice questions? There's some at the end of the chapter. Well, you know what? I got to give you some then. So, huh? There's one on the quiz. Yeah, I got to give you some practice questions with answers so that you know exactly what sequence of buttons you got to hit on your calculator. And there's probably more than one way to calculate it on your calculator, depending on what buttons you push. All right, so that's pH. What's the strange thing about pH? As the concentration here, as the concentration of hydrogen ions increases in solution, as the acidity, right, the concentration is the acidity of that solution. So if the acidity increases or if the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to the pH number? It decreases. That's really strange. If you haven't seen that before, you just have to get that ingrained in your mind. But this equation right here tells you that, right? Because where is the hydrogen ion concentration? Is it in the numerator or denominator? denominator in this pH equation, so that means that pH and hydrogen ion concentration are inversely related, right? If it's directly related, then you would just have what? pH equal to hydrogen ion concentration, but it doesn't work that way. And then if you look a little bit carefully, because it's the of the negative exponents that we have to use when we talk about hydrogen ion concentration, that they develop this equation right here. Ah, somebody tell me something about this log. One last thing. Maybe you get hung up on this. What can you tell me about this log? And your calculator, because you're going to have this relationship with your calculator. This right here is log to the base 10. I didn't write it down here. Your calculator also has a natural log. All right, base E, and we're not going to deal with that in here, so make sure you get the base 10, and it all depends on how your calculator is set up. All right, so base 10, just a regular old natural log. Okay, so that's pH. All right, tell me real quick, what's a buffer? What is a buffer? It's something that's in a solution. Yeah, so we got a buffer in solution, and then I take an acid and dump it into that beaker that has a buffer. What happens to the pH? Okay. What happens if the pH is if the pH is 10, right? And then I put some acid in that beaker, but it has a buffer. It stays the same. That's right. A buffer doesn't force it to neutrality. It keeps it at whatever that buffer, whatever the chemical properties of that buffer is. Okay. That's a good one. All right, so let's move on to some organic molecules. I want to make a distinction between organic molecules and important biological chemicals in our body. They're not exactly the same thing. So what is an organic molecule? It's got to contain a carbon, and it has to have a covalently bound hydrogen to it. All right, so when you look at that, what is that? What is a carbon? What's the symbol for carbon? Nice. And there's going to be a covalent bond. We usually signify these two electrons that are doing what? Jumping or being shared. And it's being shared to a hydrogen atom, just like that. So if you have a molecule with that in the formula, it is automatically what? An organic compound. All right, so there are very important biological molecules in us that are not organic, but they're important biological molecules. There are a lot of organic chemicals that shouldn't even come close to our body. All right, so we're going to have to look at some of these things. So for instance, let me give you a quick quiz. Here we have carbon dioxide. Our body produces that all the time. We take in sugar, it gets chopped up into CO2. What do we do with this CO2? We just exhale it right out of our body. So you would probably agree this is a very important biological molecule, because we produce it all the time. But is this an organic molecule? And your answer is correct, it's not. Because why? It doesn't have this covalently bound hydrogen to it. All right, so just kind of be aware of that. Carbon, if you look at that periodic table, I don't know if anyone has one handy, it says that it has four electrons in the outer shell. Ooh, four electrons in the outer shell, which means how many protons in the nucleus? We could work that backwards. If there's four in the outer shell, that means that there's two in the inner, so that means there's six electrons, which means to be neutral, it's got to have six protons inside the nucleus, and you could double check yourself if you look at that periodic table, right? As long as you know that carbon is represented with a C. So because it has four electrons in that outer shell, it wants to find four other electrons. It wants to participate in a covalent bond with four other elements. And then this outer shell will be filled up completely with 80 electrons if it can find four other atoms to share with. All right, so let's look at some molecules. So here I have a long carbon backbone bone, and I haven't counted, but I would guess there's six of these carbons in a row. And on each of these carbons, you see hydrogen atoms bound, covalently bound. That's what this little solid line means. There's a sharing of two electrons every time you see this little solid line. So is this an organic compound?
Yes.
Indeed it is, right? Biologically not important, highly toxic, shouldn't get close to it. But this is where we're going to start with biology, all right? So this thing right here, does it like to dissolve in water? Let's review that principle. Does it like to dissolve in water? Another way of asking that question, is it polar or nonpolar?
Non-polar.
Okay, and why do you know it's nonpolar? Because you had to memorize something already. Okay, because water is polar. But in order to have a polar covalent bond, you need one of four atoms bound to a hydrogen. What's one of those four?
Oxygen.
See oxygen?
No.
Nitrogen. See nitrogen? Sulfur. See sulfur? Phosphorus. See phosphorus? No. Right? So none of these are polar covalent bonds, so this is a nonpolar molecule. Doesn't like to dissolve in water because water is a polar molecule. Right? Okay. So what can happen is that this nice linear structure can form a ring, and this is exactly the same thing except it has formed the ring, and here we see what? Just a sharing of two electrons between this carbon and this carbon. It's a six-carbon ring, and these rings sometimes behave interesting in that sometimes a double bond is established between these two carbons, and if there's a double bond here, then one of these hydrogens has to go away. Because you can only have four covalent bonds. You end up with something that looks like this. We see two carbons, two double bonds here. I mean, a double bond here, here, and here. Right? And this thing right here is what we call benzene. So small changes, right? We take this linear molecule, make a cyclic compound out of it, and just take a couple hydrogens off, notice that we have many different kinds of chemicals. We can modify that pretty easily. Right, and all of these right here are nonpolar. So carbon, because it likes to share electrons at each of these locations right here, then you can substitute another atom where this hydrogen is, or where this one is, pretty much anywhere over the molecule. And so those things, if it's not a hydrogen bound to this carbon, we're going to call that a functional group. All right, so a functional group. When you think of function, what is function determined by? Yeah, the structure, right? So if we change the structure of this molecule by putting some other kind of element here, maybe like oxygen, we're changing the structure, it's going to change the function, and sometimes really radically, because we can change this molecule from a nonpolar molecule to a polar molecule. All of a sudden, magically, then it can dissolve in water, right? So we're going to substitute some atoms for these hydrogens. Oh, look what we have right here. We still have that linear carbon backbone, but notice in this position right here, I see a double bond to an oxygen. That's what we're going to call a carbonyl group. It has a much different function compared to that hexane molecule. Or we could substitute it with an OH. That's a hydroxyl group. All these things are nicely highlighted in yellow. And I want you to know the names of these groups that are highlighted. Here is a sulfhydryl group. All right, what can you tell me about this sulfur bound to a hydrogen? What kind of covalent bond is that? That's a nice polar covalent bond, right? So this thing will have a tendency to allow this molecule to dissolve in water. And what about this one? This amino group. Yeah, because it forms a polar covalent bond with these hydrogens. What about this oxygen? Yeah, that forms a polar covalent bond with this hydrogen. So this carbon backbone that has a lot of hydroxyls, right, or sulfhydryl groups, or what is the name of this one here? Amino. When you think of amino, you should think of this NH2 group. That means that the molecule now has a tendency to dissolve in water because it becomes polar because of those polar bonds. Whenever you see on the terminus of a hydrocarbon, a COOH, that's a carbonyl group, and this hydrogen right here can jump off very easily into solution. What do we call something that can donate something to solution when you put it in water? That's an acid, right? So this is an acidic group because of that proton right there. And, of course, then this is also makes it polar to dissolve in water. Here's a phosphorus. So I got phosphorus, oxygens. This is a highly polar end of this molecule. This is what we call a phosphate group. And we're going to love phosphate groups, right? And what kind of nature does this phosphate group have? Can it donate protons to solution, or does it gobble them up? If we look at just this molecule right here, it can donate. Can donate this one, can donate that one, right? So this base molecule is basically like a phosphoric acid, but it's an organic acid. So we have alcohols, we got acids, and these other functional groups. Okay, we'll start to look at these. I think I have a little quiz, a little flash quiz for you to practice what those things are called. On that quiz, I don't tell you what the function is, but at least begin to know what the names of those functional groups are. And why do we call these functional groups? Because when we change the structure, the function changes, right? So always go back to thinking about the structure, right? The structure of this is a lot different than that, a lot different than this, and of course it will have different functions as well. Okay, well, we saw that we can have organic compounds that are not biologically important. We can have non-organic compounds that are biologically important. And all of these compounds, most of them we can group into four categories of the important biological molecules. The first one is a carbohydrate. And the second one is going to be a protein. The third one is a lipid. And the fourth one is a nucleic acid. Okay, so we got nucleic acids, proteins, carbohydrates, and lipids. And I want you to know the building blocks of each one of these things, because you got to know building blocks before you can understand what that molecule is all about. And you probably know some building blocks already. What's a building block of a protein? Amino acid. That's right, amino acid. And when you say amino acid, what kind of functional groups does it have? It has an amino group, and it has what? A C double bond O. Right, H, right? It has that carboxyl group. And then it's got some other spot where there can be another substitution for some other kind of molecule or atom, right? So amino acid is exactly what it says. It has an amino group and that acidic group, which is what? The C with two O's and an H. All right, let's look at some carbohydrates. So here we have a six carbon backbone. And on each of these carbons right here, we see that we have a nice functional group. We have a hydroxyl group. I should have asked you that. That's a hydroxyl group. What's this group up over here? Oh, no, you don't know that one. Okay. Yeah. Okay, but here's a hydroxyl group. So this carbon backbone, if it didn't have hydrogens here, it would be nonpolar and couldn't dissolve in water. But I see a hydroxyl group, so does that change the polar nature of this molecule? Yeah, because oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, phosphorus, when bound to hydrogen, produces a polar covalent bond. So glucose has all of these polar covalent bonds. So what does glucose like to do since it has all these polar covalent bonds? And you know this, it dissolves in water very rapidly, very easily. All right, so this is what we call glucose. It is a monosaccharide. It's a sugar all by itself. And how many carbons do we have in glucose? Yeah, six. I think that will be important to know. Right? It's got six. Too bad we don't have six fingers on one hand. All right, but that's a monosaccharide. There can be different kinds of monosaccharides in our body. All right, so here is a six-carbon sugar, and it looks very, very similar, except at this location right here, notice that this hydroxyl group is on the left, and on glucose, it's over to the right. And just by that small change, that changes the chemical properties of this molecule, right? A change in structure causes a change in function. This is what we call galactose. But nonetheless, galactose is similar to glucose in that it is a monosaccharide. Here's another monosaccharide. This is fructose, right? So it still has some OH groups, hydroxyl groups, okay? And it can form a ring as well, right? So I didn't mention that, but galactose and glucose can form this ring structure. There's always some equilibrium between the linear form and this cyclic form. Here is fructose. Does fructose look different than galactose and glucose if we just look at the ring structure? Absolutely, right? So glucose, galactose have this six-sided figure, and fructose is a five-sided figure. That's because it has a couple of carbon groups hanging off the edges of it. But nonetheless, it still has six carbons. This is another example of a monosaccharide. And of course, you see all these polar covalent bonds, so that means that fructose can dissolve in water very nicely. But where can it not dissolve? Where can't fructose dissolve? Likes water? Hates lipids. Hates fats, right? Because lipids and fats are nonpolar compounds. So that's how sometimes we talk about things as either being hydrophilic or hydrophobic. All of these things are hydrophilic because of these polar covalent bonds. So when you look at something like this and that, or these ring structures, I want you to know that these are monosaccharides. I don't want you to know that this is glucose compared to this is galactose, but I do want you to be able to recognize these things as being sugars, because that's an important biological classification of molecules in our body. Now, how did they come up with this name, carbohydrate? What's the symbol for carbon? C. All right, so here we have a C, and I see a C. Let's just look in this row right here. What else do you see in this row? I see hydrogen. Yeah, I see a hydrogen. What else do you see? Oxygen. I see an oxygen. And what else do you see? What else do you see? I see a hydrogen. I see an oxygen and another hydrogen. So we got an oxygen and two hydrogens. What the heck is that? What is H2O? Water. Okay. So when somebody first started to look at these molecules for every carbon, they analyzed what? Water. An H2O. It's not really a water, but it's the same chemical formula. So they call that a carbohydrate, because every carbon has that H2O on there, but it's too difficult, right? Like hardly anybody says hypothesis. So a carbohydrate turned into carbohydrate, right? So that's how these things become carbohydrates, and these things love water. They are hydrophilic, okay? And those were all examples of monosaccharides. Well, that monosaccharide can be used as a building block to make a sugar that has two of them put together, like glucose-glucose, right, or glucose-galactose. Those are what we would call disaccharides, disaccharide. And so sucrose is just a glucose and a fructose put together. Might not be a bad idea for you to know that. Lactose or milk sugar is a glucose that has been joined together with galactose. And maltose is just two glucoses put together. And so all of these right here, sucrose, lactose, and maltose, are all what kind of sugars? They are disaccharides, right. And when you see an OSE at the end of a word like that, that's probably a really good sign that it is a sugar, right? And if you see an ASE at the end of a word, that is not a sugar. That means that it's going to be an enzyme. Well, we're going to get into enzymes a little bit later on. So, for instance, if you have something called lactase, not a lactose, but you have lactase, what do you know about lactase? It's an enzyme, and its substrate is lactose. So we'll break lactose down. Okay, sucrase, maltase. Right, these are all enzymes that can break these things down. So we're interested in how these things join together. Okay, because a lot of times there just aren't two sugars that are joined together, two monosaccharides. You can have thousands of monosaccharides that are joined together, and then they become polysaccharides. Right, a little bit more complicated. A good example of a polysaccharide is starch and glycogen. You have eaten a lot of starch in your lifetime. That is basically just a glucose molecule joined to another glucose, joined to another glucose. And plants like to make that kind of compound. It's a storage form of glucose, right? These six carbon units all jammed together. And it has some branching, but it's mostly linear. Glycogen, on the other hand, is what animals put together with glucose. So if we put a lot of glucoses together in our bodies, we don't make starch, right? But we make glycogen. Glycogen is a starch, basically, but it has a more branching pattern to it. It has more branches associated with it. All right, so these are all polymers of only one kind of monosaccharide. If these are 100% made out of glucose, right? That's the building block. So glucose is a building block of starch and glycogen. Nothing else is. So when you eat starch, what is that eating? What are you eating when you eat starch? You're eating sugar. You're eating glucose in particular, right? So there's a condition where people have trouble controlling their blood glucose levels. So I would guess people would be interested to know how much starch is in their diet, right, to help balance their insulin needs out. All right, so starch and glycogen are energy storage molecules. We're going to see where that energy comes from. And these, starch and glycogen, is just one molecule. But like I said, we could have thousands of molecules. So you have the same number of glucoses, and if you have 1,000 in solution, it's going to have a different physical chemistry property compared if you have those 1,000 glucose molecules that have been all joined together, and it only makes one molecule. And we're going to get into that. It's going to have an important effect on diffusion of water. So this is one way that cells control diffusion of water in and out of their cells, is by taking all those thousands of glucose molecules and making one out of them, which means then it's converted into starch or glycogen. That's what this, that's what it says right here. It is on the slide. Right, when organisms store thousands of glucoses in one polysaccharide, you're switching, thousands of molecules into one. That drastically reduces what we call osmotic problems. And we're going to have to go another chapter to get a really good feel of what that is. But I suppose maybe you can understand that if we have a solution that's really high in salt, it's going to have a tendency to draw water into it to dissolve, to dilute that salt concentration, right? So if you have a cell that has a high salt concentration or thousands and thousands of glucose molecules, that's going to draw water inside the cell, and eventually so much that the cell is going to explode. It's going to lyse, right? So we prevent our cells from lysing. We take thousands of those molecules, make one out of them, and now that reduces the concentration of sugar inside the cell so that water isn't pulled into the cell, it doesn't swell up, and it doesn't burst as a result of that. So it's an important storage form, but it also helps the cell maintain its shape. Bless you. Okay. Here is, what do we got right here? 6-carbon sugar. You don't have to know it's glucose, but you should know that this is a, what kind of saccharide? Monosaccharide. Here we got another glucose. It's a monosaccharide. And they're just independent of each other on this illustration. This plus just means that if we add two of these together, right, we can get a maltose molecule. And look what happens. How are these things joined together? Well, these two ends, I have an OH here, OH here. And so two H's and an oxygen get pulled off. And then we have a nice bond between that oxygen is left over. So these two are joined. And then what has been pulled off? A water molecule, and I see it over here, right? So we call this a dehydration synthesis reaction. Dehydration synthesis reaction. I think what is kind of amazing is this is a very important biological reaction, and water is a very important substrate for this reaction. It's a product, or it could be a reactant, depending on which way this reaction is going. So water has this magical property in that it is the solvent that our bodies is dissolved in, but it's an also very important biological molecule because it participates in this dehydration synthesis or condensation, right? Condensation just means that we're pulling water out of this reaction. But not just glucose, but we could have glucose fructose or glucose galactose. We take each of these monosaccharides, make a disaccharide out of them. What kind of reaction would your body use to join a glucose and a galactose molecule? Exactly what we have right here. Right? Evolution didn't have to invent a new kind of chemical reaction. It's still going to be a dehydration synthesis reaction. Glucose joined together, glucose fructose, glucose galactose joined together, all of those are dehydration synthesis reactions. Right? Okay. And if we join hundreds or many of these glucose molecules together, right, it's all going to be with a dehydration synthesis reaction. We're going to end up with a really big molecule with these repeated subunits over and over and over again. And we said that was a polysaccharide. There's a more general term for polysaccharide, right? And it just doesn't have to be sugar. We can take many different kinds of biological compounds and put basic building blocks together over and over and over again. And if it's not a monosaccharide, we can't call it a polysaccharide, right? If we put a bunch of amino acids together, that can't be a polysaccharide. But nonetheless, it is still something that we call a polymer, the most general form of a big molecule made of repeating subunits over and over again is a polymer. So a polysaccharide is a polymer. A protein is a polymer, because it has that same kind of nature to it. It has these monosaccharides joined together or amino acids joined together, for instance. All right, well, the reverse direction happens. All right, so here I see the forward direction, but remember this arrow, I guess maybe you should make a double-ended arrow right here. This disaccharide, maltose, made up of two glucoses, can be broken down into two monosaccharides, not with a dehydration synthesis reaction. Right, we're not going to pull a water out. What do we have to do? Put a water in. That's what we call a hydrolysis reaction, right? Because it needs this water to break up these two monosaccharides, hydrolysis. So hydrolysis is a reaction that breaks polymers down. Okay, so it can break maltose down into two glucose. All right, so it will take a disaccharide and make a monosaccharide out of it. All right, so how would you make a polymer from monosaccharides? What kind of chemical reaction would you use? Dehydration synthesis. I think your book likes that term a lot in questions at the end of the book, dehydration synthesis. And how would your body break a big polymer down like starch or glycogen? How would your body break, what kind of chemical reaction would your body use? Hydrolysis reaction, yeah, hydrolysis, water going back in. All right, so for now we're done with carbohydrates. Lipids. Lipids are a lot different than carbohydrates. Carbohydrates have all those important polar covalent bonds, so they like to dissolve in water. Lipids are insoluble, right, in polar solvents like water, because that's what we're interested in biology, which means that they are hydrophobic. These don't like to dissolve in water. They consist primarily of these hydrocarbon chains and maybe even some rings. So here is a pretty good example. This thing right here, what can you tell me about this C, two oxygens, and an H? That's a carboxyl group. You didn't have time to study that yet, but you'll know that's a carboxyl group, and it's an acidic group. Right? And here we have a big, long carbon backbone, and we can't draw all of them because this carbon backbone might contain maybe 18 or 20 carbons. It's really, really long, and it has all these nonpolar covalent bonds, so fatty acid is mostly lipid. It really doesn't like to dissolve in water. This end maybe a little bit, but generally not. So here, how many of these fatty acids do I see on this slide? They're on top of each other. They make a column. I see 1, 2, and 3. Three fatty acids. And the number of carbons in a fatty acid will determine what its name is. So I don't know if we're going to have to know any fatty acids specifically by their name, but it's a building block of what?
Triglyceride.
A triglyceride. Maybe you've had triglycerides measured in your blood. That's an important index of your lipid metabolism. So a triglyceride has three fatty acids joined together to another molecule over here. This is what we call glycerol. Now, glycerol sort of reminds me of half of a glucose. Why is that? Kind of reminds me of half of a glucose because it has 1, 2, 3. It has three carbons. Right. So this can be formed by the breakdown of glucose. So if your body breaks glucose down into glycerol, how many glycerols would you get for every glucose? You'd get two, right? You just snip it in half. What kind of reaction would be used to take glucose and break it down into these two pieces that have three carbons? You already know that. And that is called a hydrolysis reaction, right? When you break a big molecule down, it's usually hydrolysis. So here we have glycerol, not quite a sugar, okay, but it does have these three hydroxyl groups in these three positions. And this fatty acid has, of course, this OH group on the carboxylic end. And enzymes can pull this water molecule off and form a nice bond. And the same thing for the fatty acid at the second and the third location. So now we have a triglyceride. So what is, or what are the building blocks of a triglyceride? It is 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3 what?
Fatty
acids plus a glycerol. Yeah, a glycerol. So building blocks of a triglyceride, glycerol and three fatty acids. Right? We usually say it that way. Glycerol and three fatty acids. Glycerol, unlike these fatty acids, loves to dissolve in water. Why? Because of these polar covalent bonds on it. So here's that triglyceride. When we make a triglyceride from glycerol and three fatty acids, what else is formed? Yeah, we get three waters. What kind of reaction is that that produces these three waters? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Exact same kind of organic chemistry reaction. Evolution didn't have to develop any new fancy kind of reaction, same thing. Well, our body can break this triglyceride down into three fatty acids and a glycerol. What reaction would be used to do that, to go in the opposite direction? That would be a hydrolysis reaction, right? And that would require three oxygens, right? So that's just the theme that we're going to see over and over and over again. All right, so let's look at some fatty acids. Here's a nice fatty acid, palmitic acid. You can count the number of carbons right there. I haven't memorized it. I don't want to count it right now. But notice, between every carbon, there is just a single bond. And we know that this is a fatty acid because this end of the molecule is what? Nonpolar. And what's on the other end? What kind of group is this? This is a carboxyl group, right? And so this can ionize, and so this end of the molecule can dissolve in water a little bit. Since every bond between these carbons is just a single bond, we call that a saturated fatty acid, as opposed to unsaturated. A saturated fatty acid really means that at every carbon, there are two hydrogens. It's completely saturated with hydrogen atoms at every carbon, except for the terminal end over here and over here. As opposed to, if we take these two carbons, we can make these two carbons share four electrons instead of two. We call that a double bond. We end up with a double bond right here, which means then that this carbon and this carbon don't have an electron to share with another hydrogen atom. So this double bond, right, means that this carbon and this carbon are not completely saturated with hydrogens. That makes this an unsaturated fatty acid. And even if it had the same number of carbons in the backbone, okay, this causes a different shape of that fatty acid, which will then change the function, how it's metabolized in the body. So there's a difference between a saturated and an unsaturated fatty acid. I don't want you to know that this is palmitic and this is linoleic acid. I just want you to be able to identify what is a fatty acid, something that looks like this, and the difference between a saturated and an unsaturated fatty acid. Okay, in this class, that is good. All right, here is. This might be my favorite molecule besides water, maybe. What do we see when we look at this thing? Well, the title says phospholipid, so it's got to be a lipid with what joined to it? So a phosphate functional group. Remember that phosphate functional group was, what, a PO4 with a couple of hydrogens on it? And when I analyze, when I look at this thing, I want you to be able to analyze this molecule. For sure, this is an exam figure. You can memorize what it is, but I might turn it upside down or something, and sometimes students get lost when I turn something upside down, so make sure that you can analyze this molecule. What do we got? We have a three-carbon backbone. What does that remind you of? Glycerol. That should remind you of glycerol. And on two of these carbons, we have these long hydrocarbon chains, which are fatty acids, right? But on the third carbon, we don't have a fatty acid. What do we have? We have a phosphate group, right? We have this nitrogen over here. That means that this end of the molecule, because of all these charges and because of the, here's another charge, right? It makes this end of the molecule very polar. So here is a molecule that loves both natures. There's a part that likes to dissolve in oil. Here's another part that likes to dissolve in oil. Right? I'm sorry, water. Very good. Oil, water. Hydrophilic, hydrophobic. I got it right that time. Okay? Okay. Well, we don't want to draw this out. I don't want you to be able to draw this phosphatidyl group out, but you should know there's a phosphate in there and nitrogen, which makes it dissolve in water. We like to just draw it out like this. So there is this head group, and we can see a couple tails sticking out. The head group is what, polar or nonpolar? The head group has nitrogen and phosphorus in there. It's polar. We call that a polar head group. And then here are the hydrocarbon chains. These are the hydrophobic parts, right? Or the nonpolar, right? All in this one molecule. Okay. Well, let's just do a little, I want to do a little drawing on the board. How about if I use this pen? Can you see the color of that pen in the back? More or less in the back, you can kind of see that. Okay, so what do we got? We got this thing right here. What kind of molecule is that? You wouldn't know unless you look at this slide over here. This is a phospholipid because here are the fatty acids. That's a phosphatidyl group. Which is the polar end? Right here? Where's the nonpolar end? Down over there. Okay. So just kind of remember that for a second. I'm going to draw a special little chamber right here. Okay? And you might find this thing in your refrigerator. So, anybody reading my mind, what could be in, what is this bottle holding? Orange juice, that's pretty good. What's the nature of orange juice? Is it polar or nonpolar? What is all the orange things? What are they dissolved in? Water, right? So orange juice is pretty much just a polar system. It has water in it. There's no lipids at all. Okay, but there is a bottle in your refrigerator that has both oil and water. You got it. Salad dressing. So here's a salad dressing bottle. And we put this in there a couple weeks ago. And are we going to see water up over here and lipid over here and water, the same concentration of water and lipid everywhere, no matter where we look? It's going to separate out, right? Because they don't like each other. So you're going to have a little meniscus right here. And on the top is going to be oil. Water is a little bit heavier. And down over here, you're going to have water, H2O. All right, so the H2O has all the little tasty salts and stuff in there, right? That oil gives it a little bit, maybe a little bit of a flavor, but a different texture. And before you put salad dressing on your salad, you pour it just like that. No, because you're only going to get oil, right? You won't taste all these tasty things. So you got to shake it up, okay? So you shake it up, and then you got oil and water all mixed together. And then when you're done, you put it back in the refrigerator. Does it go back to this condition right here? Or does it stay mixed up? It goes back like that. Did you have to do anything special to get oil up here and water down over here? Or did it just happen automatically? Just automatically by the physical chemistry, the physical properties of those two molecules. All right, so let's take this thing here. What do we got here? Phospholipid. Let's put a phospholipid molecule into the salad dressing bottle. Will it wander around in the oil? Will it wander around in the water part? Or what the heck is this phospholipid going to do? Yeah, because this is the hydrophilic part. It's going to be in the water. There's part of a phospholipid. But these things are hydrophobic. They hate water. Where are they going to go? They're going to go up into the oil, like so. All right? And so if we put this one phospholipid in our salad dressing, did we have to do anything special to get it there? Do we have like a little demon running around, grab that molecule, stick it right there? I mean, it's got to be right there. Or automatic. Just automatically. It's kind of amazing that happens. Right? Just because of the physical property. Well, let's not just put one phospholipid. Maybe let's put 100 phospholipids in there. Then what will happen? They're all going to line up exactly like that. Right? They're going to line like so, like so. Like so, like so, like so, and like that. Okay? And if you look at this thing over here with a trained eye, you're going to see that this resembles a membrane that's in our bodies, a membrane that surrounds cells. And so did you have to do anything special to get this thing formed, this membrane, something that looks like a membrane? No. Automatically, right? So one of these special living structures, a membrane, have a tendency to what? Self-assemble. A very important part of cells just self-assemble because of the physical properties of that phospholipid. Okay. Okay. So make sure you can understand what a phospholipid is. Two fatty acids and this phosphate group. That's all you have to say, phosphate group. You don't really have to know what the organic chemical that is right here on the hydrophilic part of the molecule. Any questions on that? All right, but we still call phospholipid a lipid, but it's a strange one because it has a polar end. Okay? All right, let's look at the next slide. Well, if we take this salad dressing bottle and kind of shake it up, okay, we're going to destroy this meniscus right here, but nonetheless, right, these hydrophobic tails are still going to be there. And does this hydrophobic tail like this one here? Here is nonpolar. Here's nonpolar. They will be drawn together. Okay? So these nonpolar regions will be drawn together as a very, very kind of weak chemical bond. And it will form this structure. Okay? And this is what we call a micelle. Looks like a circle, but it's really a sphere. Right? And so this is going to be in water. So associated with the water is going to be what end of a phospholipid? The polar head group, right? So here's that phosphate group associating with the water because it's hydrophilic. And then all of these fatty acids here are at ease, right? They like hanging out right here because they have the same nature, right? They are hydrophobic. And so now instead of a membrane, what does this look like? It really looks more like a cell, right? So again, the basic building block of life has this tendency to self-assemble because of those physical properties. Okay, so the polar parts interact with water, the nonpolar parts interact just with themselves. And so basically this kind of almost looks like a detergent. We can call that a surfactant because this molecule, right, this end right here, if you have oil on your clothes, oil can dissolve into this part, and this will dissolve in water, and you mix these things together, and this will kind of take oil out of your clothes, and then since it's in water, you can flush it down the drain. Okay, the other thing, here's surfactant. Maybe I'll just describe a little something. Here we have a water molecule. Do you see a water molecule right here? H2O. And we said water is polar, depending on what end of the molecule you look at. So what end, what's the electrical charge where I have the cursor right now? Negative. Now you see there's a negative, so over here is positive. So on this negative end of the molecule of water, there's going to be another water molecule right next to it. How is the one next to it going to orient? Okay, so here is the hydrogen is going to now flip around to the other side so that you have the positive charge interacting with the negative. They're going to have a tendency to cancel out. All right, so there is an attraction. Do you see that there is an attraction between these two water molecules? And what about the next one over here? It flips around so that these two are attracted to each other. And over here, all the way around, these water molecules are attracted to each other. All right, we call that surface tension. Water really is kind of sticky. It likes to stick together. And that can be a problem under certain circumstances. And something that can break these bonds is what we call a surfactant. And that the bonding between water molecules, if it's on the surface of water, we call that surface tension. Okay, surface tension. That surface tension, those attractions between molecules can be broken down by surfactants. It can be broken down by surfactants. We're going to look at surfactants for sure when we get into the respiratory system. All right, here are some more lipids. And these are what we call steroids. They're all going to have this basic form, and they're all derived from cholesterol. So what's derived from cholesterol? Cortisol. Cortisone. Have you ever heard of those things before? Are they good or bad? Yeah, they're pretty good to have in the right amount. Okay. What about testosterone? Okay. It's made from cholesterol. Testosterone, good or bad? Generally good, right? Okay. What about estradiol? That's an estrogen. Good or bad? I don't know anybody that doesn't want to have some of these things in their body, right? And what do you know about cholesterol? Good or bad? Okay, depends on how you want to think about it, right? You need some to do what? Make steroids like testosterone, estrogens, right? And corticosteroids like cortisol. So you need the right amount so that you can build these hormones right here, right? But if you have too much, that causes cardiovascular disease. So I want you to recognize these things as being steroids. I don't want you to know that this is estrogen, testosterone, right, or cortisol, but I want you to know these are steroids by their shape, which is what? Here's like one step, another step, and even sometimes a third step, right? So we have the 6-carbon ring, another one up over here, and then this 5-carbon ring making this like stair-step arrangement. And here I see just mostly carbons and hydrogens. So here's cholesterol. Does cholesterol like to dissolve in water? No. It's a nonpolar compound. Okay? And the same thing pretty much for the rest of these steroids right here as well. Okay, I think I used maybe one of these as an example when we looked at a chemical experiment. I said, okay, we designed a nice drug that's a steroid and we want to give this to a person. We want them to get that into their body. What would we use to dissolve that steroid in before we give them an injection? This is just a little recap. Could you have water as the vehicle for dissolving that steroid? No, you need oil, right? So you take your steroid, put it in oil, dissolve it in oil, give somebody a shot of that oil. And for a chemical experiment, then what would you have to do to make sure that the oil wasn't causing the effects you were looking at? You'd have to give them a shot of Just the oil, not the steroid, right? Because even the oil has these steroid properties, because steroids and oil are lipids, right? They are nonpolar compounds. All right, so be able to recognize these as steroids. Can you tell that these look different than sugar molecules?
Yeah.
Absolutely. They're both rings, right, but really totally different. You'll be able to develop an eye for that. All right, what was a fatty acid? Let's go back. Here's a fatty acid, right? Nice linear form of a fatty acid. Sometimes they can be bent, make a little, like a hairpin curve in them. And here are some that are bent. You see the carboxyl group and the long hydrocarbon chain, and it's kind of bent in half. Maybe there's some other functional groups that are put on the hydrocarbon chain at various locations. These things are what we call prostaglandins. And prostaglandins are important signaling compounds. You could almost think of them as hormones. And they're derived from, where prostaglandins derive from fatty acids. So that's why we stick prostaglandins in the lipid category right here. Okay, prostaglandins derived from fatty acids. Okay, how would we make, how do we make a triglyceride? Well, I tell you what, let's start even more simple than that. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? One glycerol and three fatty acids. All right, you should know what that glycerol molecule looks like. Maybe draw it out tonight a couple times. All right, just draw it out. It's a really simple molecule, three carbons, a couple hydroxyl groups, right, and that's it. And you know what glycerol looks like. But a triglyceride is one glycerol, three fatty acids. Those fatty acids don't have to be the same. If we substitute for one fatty acid that phosphate group, which is we call that a phosphatidyl group, you no longer have a triglyceride. What would you have? You would have a phospholipid. Right, so how does your body make a triglyceride from three fatty acids and glycerol? This is where I wanted to end up. How does your body make a triglyceride? What kind of reaction? How does your body make a disaccharide? Can you remember that disaccharide? Maybe you can find it in your notes. It's through a dehydration synthesis reaction. How does your body make a triglyceride from the building blocks? A dehydration synthesis reaction. All right, how would your body break down a triglyceride into three fatty acids and glycerol? Hydrolysis reaction, okay? And let's look at some proteins. This is the second class of biological molecules that we're going to look at. They all have this general formula. All right, and when I look at this formula right here, I see a C, two oxygens, and an H, COOH. You know that, or you will know that after you study a little bit. This is the carboxyl group, right? And here we have, on the other end, a substitution with an NH2. This is an amino group. So what do we call something that has this carboxyl group and this amino group? Okay, this is what we call an amino acid, because the carboxyl group is an acid. It's an organic acid. Right. This center carbon is kind of special. Sometimes maybe we even call this the alpha carbon, but it's like right in the middle of this fatty acid. And here I have an H, and sticking up over here is an R. That means this R could be a number of different kinds of things. It could be a hydrogen, or maybe it could be another carboxyl group, or it could be some other fancy kind of group. Different amino acids all have this general formula, but this R changes depending on what kind of amino acid it is. And what is made from this amino acid once again? Amino acids make what? It's made up of amino groups and carboxyl groups, but if we have an amino acid, what can we make with amino acids?
Protein.
Yeah, protein. Okay. So we want to know something about these building blocks. And as a matter of fact, if we put a bunch of these amino acids together, we get a protein for sure. But what is a more general name for that kind of chemical or molecule? If we put a bunch of building blocks over together over and over and over and over again, that's a polymer, right? So a protein is a polymer, starch is a polymer, but the building blocks are just a little bit different. Say we want to put two amino acids together. What kind of reaction would your body use? Same kind of reaction for making a polymer of sugars, right? And those lipids, it's going to be a dehydration synthesis reaction. Same kind of reaction. Okay. Here we have a couple different groups of amino acids. What did you know about this sulfur group covalently bound to hydrogen? polar, right? Polar covalent bond, right? So here is a what we call a polar amino acid. Same thing for these over here because of that carboxyl group. Look at all these nitrogens. Remember that produces polar covalent bonds. What about this valine and tyrosine? Do you see anything that would confer polarity to this amino acid? No. So this amino acid is more nonpolar, right? So different amino acids can have different properties, right? Some can be acids, some can be polar, nonpolar. All depends on what happens with this R. But we add that functional group, right? The functional group can change. We're going to see how that changes in a whole bunch of different chapters in this textbook. All right, so these are amino acids. Probably you should be able to identify this as an amino acid. Would that be tough to do compared to a steroid? Compared to a sugar? No. Compared to a fatty acid? No, it's easy, right? I think you should be able to see that, right? Amino acid, the amino group, and the acidic group right here. Okay. Well, look what we have here. I see an amino acid. I see another one. Is this an amino acid here? Amino group, carboxyl group. What about this one? Amino group, carboxyl group. Right. We can join these together to make a protein or a peptide if it's really short. And right, what kind of reaction would be used to join these amino acids together to make this polymer or this protein? Dehydration synthesis reaction. And so here is that bond. So here's the water that's pulled out between these two, right? Another water here, another water right here to make these three what we call peptide bonds. So you're ending up with three water molecules, right? So you pull water out, that's a dehydration synthesis. Sometimes it's called condensation, right? So here now we have a peptide or a protein. Generally, we would call something this small a peptide. And here is the peptide bond between these amino acids. It's a relatively stable bond. It's a tough bond, right? I think that's really good because our bodies don't break apart because of that. We don't break down just into amino acids very easily. And if we eat a protein, guess what? They're very difficult to digest, right? And so you need a stomach and a small intestine. You need a very acidic environment and then a very basic environment, right, in series to break this kind of chemical bond down because it is so stable. How would you break a protein down into its building blocks? Okay, that's really close. Yeah, you would denature the protein. You change the shape of it for sure. Okay, but what kind of chemical reaction? How do you break down starch? Hydrolysis. How do you break down a triglyceride? Hydrolysis reaction. How do you break down a protein? Hydrolysis reaction. Okay? Boom, boom, boom. Just like that. Okay. So if you have a polymer of amino acids that's less than 100 amino acids long, we call that a polypeptide. If it's got 100, over 100, we call that a protein. That's kind of a loose designation. It's not absolute like that, but that's not a bad way to think of it. Okay. Question at all?
Question.
Yeah.
So is it the peptide bond made the same like OT, right? They just use it differently, right?
This right here, peptide bond?
Yeah.
Yeah? What about it? I see one here, I see one here, and I see one here. Same bond. It's the same bond. But I don't understand your question.
No. Can you say again, what is a peptide bond?
Oh. A peptide bond is this bond right here between amino acids. It's formed by a dehydration synthesis reaction when this OH and this H get pulled off from these two different amino acids, right? Then it forms this bond right here, peptide bond, via a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay? Because here you see that water. Going back the other way, that would be a hydrolysis reaction. Okay. All right, there's our peptides and proteins. Well, when we look at a protein, it's just a really long sequence of amino acids put together. Right? And if there's a lot, then we call it protein. If there's less, sometimes we call that a peptide. So on this illustration right here, I see a carbon, right, with this functional group. Here's that amino group. Here's the carboxyl group of the next amino acid, right, with another functional group. So here's that centered carbon, that alpha carbon that we see all the time. I mean, here, here, and here. So we have three amino acids joined together, and each amino acid could be different, And so this is what we call the primary structure of a protein. We have to know what amino acid is next to each other in this chain of amino acids, just the linear sequence. Right, and so one could be valine, one could be glycine, or you could have glycine, glycine, glycine. Right, if you know what amino acids are next to each other, you know what the primary structure is, because those amino acids determine what the structure of that chain is going to be. If you change the amino acid, what's going to happen? Structure is going to change, function is going to change as well. Okay. So primary structure just tells you how to spell out a protein in terms of the letters being the amino acid. Maybe you have to listen to that one again. But the primary sequence is just how you spell a word out with letters. If you change the spelling in a word, you change the letters around in a word, what happens to the word? It changes. Yeah, the meaning changes. Same thing for this protein that we're building. Okay. Well, this molecule that's really long doesn't like to stay really long and rigid like a pencil that's on your desk. It likes to bend around, right? Because these bonds can rotate a little bit. And sometimes they form this staircase, this spiral staircase. We call this an alpha helix. It all depends on the functional groups. They have to fit together. They have to have the same nature, right? The hydrophilic ones have to be next to the hydrophilic ones. The hydrophobic have to be next to an amino acid with another hydrophobic region, right? And so I see a dotted line. See this dotted line here and here? That represents a bond. Not a covalent bond, but what's the weakest bond that we've looked at so far?
Hydrogen
bonds, right? So these different amino acids in the chain, right, are just in the right location to form these hydrogen bonds that stabilizes the structure into something that looks like a spiral staircase or an alpha helix. This structure right here is not what we call primary structure. We call this secondary structure. The secondary structure of a protein is where do we find these regions that have the spiral staircase? There's another one that's not in your book. Maybe it's in your book, but it's called a beta pleated sheet, and it's going to look like that. Can you see that in the back? All right, so what kind of structure is this thing right here? Oh, this is like taking a pretty big leap. What kind of structure? Is this primary structure or secondary structure? Secondary structure. This alpha helix, is this primary structure or secondary structure? It's secondary structure. What's the building block for secondary structure? The building block for secondary structure is what? Just the sequence of these amino acids. And what do we call that sequence? The definition of how we put these things together, their primary structure. So the building block of secondary structure is primary structure. All right, and after all of these secondary structures form in a protein, all right, then, and don't forget a protein is a lot longer than what we see right here, there's going to be other parts of that protein that bend and fold, curve around back on itself. And it might look like this, right? So what do we got here? Can you see this in three dimensions? If you see it in two, it kind of looks like a beta pleated sheet, but in three dimensions, you should see this as alpha helix, right? So here is a certain region where we can see that fancy kind of secondary structure. That's going to mean that this region is going to be relatively straight, but there's going to be other regions of the protein that have different kinds of straight sections and curved sections to it. When we look at the overall structure of a protein in its final way that it all twists around to form this glob right here, we call that the tertiary structure. So it has a three-dimensional shape, which is different than this alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet, much more complicated structure. There can even be cavities inside this protein where other kinds of atoms, right, can join. Like, for instance, a really big organic molecule can fit inside this protein. This is called a heme group. And the heme group even has an iron, has an Fe, and that Fe likes to absorb oxygen, likes to associate with oxygen. So this is a component of hemoglobin that we have in our body. So this molecule can transport oxygen because of that heme group on the inside. All right, so what's the building block of tertiary structure? Secondary structure, right? You need the secondary structure right here to form that little cavity. And if we disrupt The secondary structure, tertiary structure can't form. Maybe we no longer have that nice little pocket that accepts that heme group. And then can this molecule carry oxygen anywhere? It cannot, right? Because then we change the function of it, right? It can't get right in there. All right, so this is not a very stable molecule because we saw that it is made up of, this alpha helix is made mostly by hydrogen bonds, right? And hydrogen bonds between other neighboring regions within this protein. And so those are weak bonds, and those weak bonds can be broken by a number of things. Can be broken by heat, because heat is just a measure of energy, measure of temperature. And as we increase the temperature of a molecule, what does a molecule do as the temperature increases? Right? It moves. Molecules are always moving around. If the temperature increases, then the amount of that motion increases. Right? And as the temperature gets higher, motion increases more. Right? So they're directly related to each other. If we cool something down, that motion slows down. And water, something special with water happens right around 0 degrees Celsius. The motion has slowed down so much now that those bonds, those hydrogen bonds between water molecules can form a crystal out of it. We call that freezing, right? Now, there is a temperature where all motion completely stops, but you got to get really, really cold. That's what, minus 273 degrees Kelvin, which is really cold. I don't know how many degrees in Celsius that is. Okay, or Fahrenheit. All motion stops. I don't think we've ever observed anything at that temperature because it's too cold. Okay, so as you increase the temperature, the motion increases. If we increase the motion of this protein right here by, how would we increase the wiggling around and vibration of this molecule? How could we increase that? By, yeah, heating it up. All right, we could heat it up so much that we break those hydrogen bonds. And then when we break the hydrogen bonds, what kind of structure are we destroying? We're destroying the secondary structure, and if we destroy the secondary structure, what happens to the tertiary? It gets destroyed too, because that secondary structure is the building block for tertiary structure. When the protein changes shape like that, okay, we call that denaturation. And different things can change the shape of this protein. It can be pH, change the pH, salt concentration, for instance, is another way to change the shape of this molecule. And if the molecule has its function, and of course you would agree with this, if it has a function determined by its shape, if we change the shape by putting it in the wrong pH or put a lot of heat into it or salt concentration, we change the shape, then we change the activity of whatever that protein is designed to do. Maybe it's an enzyme. It will no longer catalyze the reaction. And it's going to change shape. Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about denaturation. It's a irreversible process. Once a protein becomes denatured, it cannot go back to what we call its native configuration or conformation. Right? And so if it's an enzyme and you denature it, change its shape, it loses its activity. So that enzyme will forever be, what, deactivated. And a good way to think of that, I think this happened to me just last night. I was cooking a hamburger, right? So I get a hamburger, raw hamburger out of the refrigerator, and I put it on the barbecue, and I start cooking it, and it gets perfect, right? So I'm ready to have a perfect hamburger. I get the hamburger, bring it inside, ready to eat it. I get a phone call. You know, it's those my friends that are shooting pool. And again, there's only three people. They need a fourth person. So I have a choice. Do I shoot pool with my friends, or do I eat my perfect hamburger? Well, for sure, I'm not going to eat my hamburger, right? I'm going to go shoot pool, but that's okay. The hamburger isn't wasted. I'll put it back in the refrigerator. So I have the I have the hamburger now cold. It was raw, remember, when it was in the refrigerator the first time. So now I take those same proteins, put it back at the same temperature, cold. Does it go back to looking like a raw hamburger? You all know it doesn't. Because what was the process that was used to make it look cooked? Yeah, heat. And we call that process denaturation, right? Denaturation is irreversible. Once something is denatured, once a protein is denatured, you can't get it back. So you can cook food with heat. You can cook food with pH. Who knows a food that has been cooked that you've eaten? Ceviche, yeah. And what's the acid? Yeah, like lemon oil, lemon juice, right? That's an acid. Salt can be used. Maybe you've eaten some salty foods. They've been preserved or cooked with high salt concentration. And the only thing that's happening there is what? The denaturation of those proteins, right? Which stabilizes it, makes it, just makes it safer to handle. You don't need as much refrigeration. So that's one of the reasons why we like to denature things. Right. If anybody ever comes up with an example of denaturing a protein and it's a reversible process, I would like to know. I only know one example. Okay, I do know one example. Does anybody have an example they could maybe share with us? Okay. Well, some people have straight hair and they want to have curly hair. Some people have curly hair and they want to have straight hair. Okay. Well, that's just the way it is, right? So they call that a permanent. Right, so if somebody has straight hair, they can go see a beautician and they can take your straight hair, put it in some kind of curling form, and then they reform those, the bonds between the sulfur-containing amino acids, which are covalent bonds, they're very strong bonds. They break those bonds, put the hair in a certain configuration, rebuild the bonds. Now the hair is in that curly form, and they take the curlers out, and now that hair is curly. Okay. But is it possible to reverse a perm? I don't really know for sure, but people tell me, yeah, you can reverse a perm if you want to. I don't know what the process is, but it's probably pretty rough on here, I would guess. Right? Just even getting a permanent is probably pretty rough. And so what happens when you reverse a permanent is what? Renaturing that particular protein. Right? So that's one example of a protein denaturation that is reversible. Right. So straight hair to curly hair, denature the proteins, right? And if you want to go back for whatever reason, then you renature those proteins to get them back to their natural shape. So that would be one example, for instance. Okay, let's look at how what are some of the bonds associated with making tertiary structure of a protein. Okay, here is a functional group. And we can see that this is a polar, right? There's a polar bonds in here. Here is an oxygen bound to a hydrogen. This is a nice polar covalent bond. So we have two amino acids in vastly different locations of this protein that have these polar amino acids. They will like to associate with each other via a hydrogen bond. It's a weak bond, but nonetheless, it is a bond. So this end of the protein is what? Weakly attracted to each other. You can have ionic bonds, right? You could have this amino group and this carboxyl group. So here we have a nice ionic bond that's a little bit stronger, but these amino acids are in vastly different locations of the protein, but when the protein folds just in the right way, these things come together to form an ionic bond. That helps stabilize this particular conformation. All right, let's look over here. So here's an amino acid, and then way down over here, right, if we go down through primary structure, we see another amino acid with a sulfur group on it. The amino acid that has the sulfur group is cysteine. And when you have amino acids with cysteine, these two sulfur groups can form a nice sharing of these two electrons. What kind of bond is this when these two electrons are being shared? Covalent. What kind of bond is that? Strong or weak? Strong. So in this location right here, there's a strong attraction. It's hard to break this bond. These are the ones that are broken when somebody gets a permanent, right? Okay, so this disulfide bridge, it says covalent bond right here, stabilizes the protein really nicely. So we talked about what? Ionic bonds, hydrogen bonds, covalent bonds, and then the last kind, and a lot of people maybe wouldn't even call this a bond, but I like to call it a bond. This is absolutely the weakest kind of bond that we're going to run into. And it's a bond between polar regions, between polar compounds. It's weaker than a hydrogen bond, right? Hydrogen bond is between two molecules that have some polarity to them, right? These van der Waals forces, right, are between two molecules or two ends of a molecule that are nonpolar, and of course, they like to associate with each other, right? They don't like to be in water. They like to join each other. So this tertiary structure is made by strong bonds, not so strong bonds, weak bonds, and then really weak bonds, the van der Waals force. Right? So I want you to consider Vanderbilt's forces a bond, and it's the weakest one. So now that you know that, would you say hydrogen bonds are the weakest bond?
No.
What are? Vanderbilt's forces. Yeah, Vanderbilt's. Okay. So this is a pretty nice illustration. I don't know if that's an exam figure or not. I'm not really sure. Yeah, good. Because it shows all those neat bonds that can stabilize the molecule. All right, well, here we have what the tertiary structure of that protein that we just made. It has a certain kind of shape, and it has a certain kind of shape so that if we get another one of these, they can join together. Right? Kind of like a hand going into a glove. And here is what a hemoglobin molecule really looks like. Right? It's got two subunits that look the same and another two subunits that are like each other but a little bit different than the first two that I mentioned. These four subunits come together to form a molecule. This is what we call the quaternary structure. And it just so happens that in this particular case we have four subunits that come together. And each one of these subunits has that heme group on the inside. So for every hemoglobin molecule, how many oxygens can it carry in the blood? It can carry four because of these four heme groups in the hemoglobin molecule. So this is what we call the quaternary structure. If it's quaternary structure, two proteins have to come together somehow to form one molecule. And those are stabilized by hydrogen bonds, right? Ionic bonds, maybe covalent bonds, but I'm not aware of any. That's a quaternary structure. So what's the building block of quaternary structure? Tertiary structure. What's the building block of tertiary? Secondary. And what's the building block for secondary? Primary, which just is the sequence of amino acids, right? If we change the primary structure of a protein, what does that change? Secondary structure. And what does that change? Tertiary structure. What does that change? Quaternary structure, all the way up and down the line, because you're changing the function of these things. I mean, you're changing the structure, which then changes the function. Okay. All right, next time, I'm going to start. I meant to pass around a sign-in sheet. It's a blank piece of paper with lines on it. And I think I had the date on there. I would like for you to sign that. Next time, I hope I have an Excel spreadsheet with everybody who's registered for the class and you'd sign next to your name. But always sign the sign-in sheet so I know you are here in class. That's your receipt. Nucleic acids, that's the last kind of biological molecule we're going to look at.